Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Greetings. This is Dave Kale of the Silmarillionaires, also known as Tara Tanamir, the not-quite-so-deathless. Welcome to episode 17 of the Silmarillion Seminar, How You Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm After They've Seen Gondolin? This week we analyze the chapter entitled Of Maeglin. Despite the chapter's nominal focus on the troubled and troublesome son of Eol, discussion nevertheless ranges far and wide, covering diverse topics such as Martinshaw's mispronunciation of Maeglin's name, connections, however tenuous, between Gondolin and Gondor, other echoes of the Gondolin myth in Tolkien's works, moral ambiguity in Tolkien being far more widespread than most people give him credit for, and Eol's extremely complicated nature as dangerous loner, jealous possessor, dark elf, and tragic victim. Toward the end of the episode, you'll also enjoy a special dramatic reenactment, courtesy of the Silmarillionaire's acting troupe, including yours truly. Oh, and we did eventually find our way to the chapter's titular character, Maeglin, particularly his paucity of dialogue. I mean, come on! The guy needs to get a new agent. Finally, it is worth noting that this chapter, like other recent ones, is set in the calm before the storm, and is sowing the seeds of destruction to come very soon.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I think I got things situated here. Let's get going. We're talking about Maeglin tonight, so we'll get a bunch of Gondolin stuff in, and also get to talk not only about Maeglin, of course, but his sketchy dad, Eol, who is, I think, a pretty unusual character among the elves of the First Age. So looking forward to that. I want to start off, as usual, with sort of some of the sort of simpler clarifications and pronunciations and things. Eol is how you pronounce the name of Maeglin's sketchy dad, and Maeglin is how you pronounce the name of the titular character of this chapter. This is, of course, as I've mentioned before, one of the famous two most prominent characters that Martinshaw pronounces incorrectly consistently all through his reading of the Silmarillion, that is Maedhros and Maeglin, both of which should be I and not A. So he says it Maeglin all the way through. This is one I sometimes have a hard time with, or that is, I'll sometimes slip, because both of these, I pronounced it that way too. When I was first reading it to myself, when I was in high school and college, and so I didn't sort of catch myself there for a long time, so I will still sometimes slip into my old way of pronouncing it. But anyway, Maeglin is the correct pronunciation. Let's see, Matt has two questions. The first, there's the reference to the fell creatures of Ungoliant, who are attacking the escort of Aradhel. And yeah, those are spiders. Those are like Shelob's brothers and sisters, basically. Shelob, we know, is the last child of Ungoliant, and the rest of her kids were there in Arad Gorgoroth. So yeah, so imagine like four or five Shelobs chasing after you, and that's basically what they were facing there. So yeah, you can see why they had a little bit of trouble and ended up running off home. Matt also had a linguistic question. The Iach, I-A-C-H suffix, that is in the words Arosiach and Brithiach. That means ford. So the Arosiach, as usual, as we've seen so many times before, the actual translation of the Elvish word is just like the simplest thing that it could possibly be. Arosiach just translates to the ford of Eros. The river Eros is, and there's a ford there. So Arosiach is the ford of Eros, and the Brithiach is the ford that's near the forest of Brethil. So, that's pretty simple, but the Iach suffix clearly means ford, the place where you cross the river. Those were the relatively simple ones, I think. Let's start with Gondolin. We do Gondolin first, in this chapter. So let's start with Gondolin and Turgon, and then we'll talk about Arathel, and then Eol, and then Maeglin, and the conclusion of the story. And we'll do. Matt has recommended that we read aloud the passage from with Eol and Curufin, like two of the nastiest elves in the First Age, being snarky to each other. So I agree, that's a pretty good passage. So we can totally do that. But let's start off with Gondolin. John, you had a couple things that you wanted to say about Turgon. I think we could start there, especially thinking back to the conversation that we had last time about Turgon and Finrod and their kind of looking backwards towards Valinor.
I wanted to first discuss the concept that Gondolin is portrayed in this passage as this very mysterious place. You know, originally, Gondolin's name, as I discussed last time, was Ondolinde, and it was changed, of course, I believe, by Ulmo or by someone else to basically Gondolin's City of Stone. And characters throughout this chapter, even Maeglin gets the interpretation of Gondolin as this very remote and distant force, as basically a buffer against Morgoth, but that is not as openly available or as accessible as, let's say, Doriath, though Doriath is protected by the Girdle of Melian. Now, I would like also to address the different viewpoints Turgon has over the exile of the Noldor with Arathel, his sister. Now, we see Turgon, in the beginning, basically being content to remain within his own realm. He's created Gondolin, and he's happy with that. He's fine. But Arathel seeks wider countries to ride around in. She seems to be far more bold or reckless, depending on how you look at it. And her outlook, I find, somewhat similar to Gladriel, in the sense that, you know, she wants to have her own sense of power in this new country. She wants to explore. And this, you know, conception, whether it's rebelliousness or whether it's courageousness, seems to be aiming her towards basically this this goal or this objective, which is contrary to the whole concept of Gondolin. Gondolin is by far one of the most secretive strongholds of the Noldor. If you compare it to Doriath and Nargothrond, both Doriath and Nargothrond, while Morgoth does not have a clear place for them on the map, he, you know, technically speaking, it's protected not in the same manner in which Gondolin is. Gondolin is fenced in. It is surrounded. It is protected by Thorondor and the eagles. So with this special kind of very individualized elvish protection, we see a different ideal of the Noldor coming through. And Eol represents this later on, but I'd like to touch on this now because I think it heavily relates to the perception of Gondolin. I mean, Eol perceives the people of Turgon as a threat. He basically says to Maeglin, you know, you are my son and of the Teleri, and you will have no dealings with the Noldor. As basically this, you know, this view of the Noldor being invaders, you know, kicking out or driving forth the people of the Teleri from their homeland. And of course, you know, we get conflicting point of views here back and forth. But what is pretty consistent, and I believe Tolkien's point here, is that in the beginning, in the last chapter, we saw a perception of Gondolin as it was within the walls of Gondolin. Whereas now what we're seeing here in this chapter is that look, of course, but also a sense of what it's like, you know, on the outside. What people are experiencing in terms of the rumor, the whisper. You know, instead of the whisper of the nameless fear, this is the whisper of the nameless hope. Or I shouldn't say nameless, but, you know, we get Gondolin of the Seven Names. You know, we're only hearing of the Seven Names in the Book of Lost Tales. We don't hear them here. But we do hear Gondolin the One, the City of Stone. And it is, by far, very secretive. So, sorry to ramble on, but that's my wonderful dissertation.
No, good. I mean, I think there's a lot to think about with Gondolin here. And I'm glad that you brought up the name again as well, because the name is something that I meant to get back to last week but didn't. I think it is really fascinating that we see that sort of the contrast between the two names, which are very similar, though that when it gets translated in a different language, when it's called something else, again, Turgon does name it Ondolinde, which means the the Vale of the Song of Water, because he talked all of the waterfalls there. But it's changed to Gondolin, which just means hidden rock. And that, of course, is sort of is the one that catches on. And John, as you pointed out, both this week and last, it is kind of affirmed by Olmo. That's what Olmo calls it. But yes, I mean, I think that is really interesting that Turgon's name for it actually doesn't have anything to do with secrecy, but has everything to do, with sort of music and so basically sort of the celebration of the beauty that he has found, there in Gondolin, with, of course, a polite little nod to Olmo himself. Of course, it's the voice of Olmo that you can hear in the waters. But then what the actual identity of it, the actual common name of it, just has to do with its secrecy. And its secrecy is certainly the important thing. One of the changes, Gondolin is always going to be, always was and still will be the last refuge of the Noldor, in Beleriand after Morgoth breaks the Leaguer and starts kicking butt. As the story changed over time from the original versions of it, basically sort of it became less alone. In the first versions, in the Book of Lost Tales, Gondolin is the only thing, essentially, of the Noldoran realms that survives the first battle. You know, we get in the Silmarillion, we'll see once Morgoth busts out, there are basically three refuges that are left. You've got Gondolin, and you've got Nargothrond, and you've got Doriath, and then they'll each drop one by one, and Gondolin is the last. But as I said, it's sort of a little bit less unique in these later versions, than it was in Tolkien's original thinking, but that was always really central to Gondolin. And I think, you know, that the point that you make, John, about Turgon's satisfaction with Gondolin is, I think, a really interesting one. That you're certainly right to say Turgon, although as we were talking about, he's looking back at Valinor. He's not just pining away for Valinor. He is content where he is. And his retreat, his concealment is not merely a sort of a tactical or sort of strategic, retreat. He's like in sort of retirement, he does seem to be genuinely content to keep himself sealed away. And that seems to be fine. Now, of course, Arathel is not. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. Brandon, you had wanted to say something before.
I always thought, etymologically, there might have been a tie between Gondor and Gondolin, and almost in their architecture too, as sort of these high white places that, I guess Gondor isn't that secret, but I don't know if there's any sort of ties there of Tolkien. I seem to recall some sort of connection between the two. Are we supposed to be making those types of connections, or do they just not have anything to do with each other?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say they have nothing to do with each other. I mean, certainly, you do have a similar root, Gondolin and Gondor, the similar root there. Gond is the one that means stone. Gondor is the land of stone, and Gondolin is the hidden rock, the hidden stone. So that's sort of the linguistic tie there, and why the names are similar. It's not a coincidence that you've got Minas Tirith, and of course the most prominent architectural feature of Minas Tirith is the White Tower of Ichthelion. Ichthelion, of course, is named after one of the captains of Gondolin. Glorfindel and Ichthelion are the two great captains of Turgon. Apart from Maeglin, of course, who will be until he goes bad, or rather worse. He's one of the chief captains. In fact, we will see Ichthelion killing a Balrog and, of course, dying in the fall of Gondolin. Certainly. And obviously, you know, we would have to be trying really hard not to be thinking about Gondolin when we get to the Tower of Minas Tirith, which, of course, we've already met briefly in our geographical survey a few weeks ago. And of course, Minas Tirith, as you will probably remember, just means the Tower of Guard. So you can see how that's kind of a generic name, and you'd see why that would be used more than once. But yeah, I mean, I mentioned the tower, not only the name of the tower, that it's the Tower of Icthelion, and Icthelion is named after the captain of Gondolin, but the most prominent architectural feature of Gondolin itself also is the Great Tower of Turgon. It also has a great central tower, and sort of the moment when Gondolin falls, like sort of when the fall of Gondolin is official, is when that tower, the Great Tower of Turgon, topples over. So I don't think that connection is imaginary at all. But at the same time, I wouldn't make too much of it. I wouldn't make too much of it in the sense of really drawing direct parallels between the two, because obviously there are some major differences. Yeah, as you say, you don't have that sense of secrecy. Gondor, you know, and Minas Tirith, they're not a refuge, you know, for people to retreat to in the same sense that there's no concealment offered there. And, you know, concealment is sort of the number one thing. You know, Gondolin is like this, and again, John, coming back to some of the language that you were using, you know, it is like this, almost this secret hope. As you say, not nameless. It's got lots of names. It's like the opposite of nameless. But it is this name of hope, which is no more than a name to most people. But there it is. And, of course, Gondor is a refuge in a sense and brings, but it just operates totally differently. It is a stalwart tower, essentially the role kind of strategically that Gondor is playing with Mordor, with Sauron, is more like what the Noldor are doing in the siege of Angband here. That is, they are, you know, they have guarded, and when Gondor is established, part of the reason that it's established there is to guard the crossings of the river and to keep Sauron penned up in Mordor, is even before the battles of the Last Alliance. This is why, you know, they see themselves as guarding the fences there of Mordor. So again, it's not really functioning like Gondor, like Gondolin. So I wouldn't make too much of it, but there's no question. What you can see is that Gondolin will continue to be this iconic, this mythic, this mythic thing, this mythic story to the people in the Third Age. Remember also the impact that it has on Bilbo when Bilbo remembers, when he realizes that his sword Sting was made in Gondolin, just like Gandalf's sword and Thorin's sword. Of course, you'll remember, or maybe you've forgotten, but it's fun to remember when we get to this point in the Silmarillion, Glamdring, Gandalf's sword, is Turgon's sword. And the sword of one of his captains, possibly Icthelion, is Orcrist. So those swords are from Gondolin itself. And so when Bilbo is sitting there for the first time, when he draws Sting for the first time, of course it's not named Sting yet, when he draws his sword for the first time in the Goblin tunnels, and he realizes that it's an elvish blade, and that it feels rather splendid to think that he is carrying a sword out of Gondolin. It is legendary, and just becomes within the mythic world of the Lord of the Rings. Gondolin is already a mythic story, and it's clear how that operates. Now I'm kind of rambling on about Gondolin. Does anyone else have any other thoughts about Turgon? What do you make of the exchange? We might as well jump ahead to this extent, that is, to the exchange between Turgon and Eol at the end, when Eol has his sort of defiant speech to Turgon, and then Turgon makes his solemn proclamation at the end, not the one where he's condemned to death, but his rejoinder. It's worth reading. Let's read some bits here tonight. Let's see. Okay, page 137 we're looking at. Okay. Eol says, I acknowledge not your law. No right have you or any of your kin in this land to seize realms or to set bounds either here or there. This is the land of the Teleri, to which you bring war and all unquiet, dealing ever proudly and unjustly. I care nothing for your secrets, and I came not to spy upon you, but to claim my own, my wife and my son. Yet if in Arathel, your sister, you have some claim, then let her remain. Let the bird go back to the cage, where soon she will sicken again as she sickened before, but not so Maeglin. My son you shall not withhold from me. Come, Maeglin, son of Eol, your father commands you. Leave the house of his enemies and the slayers of his kin, or be accursed. But Maeglin answered nothing. I love that last sentence. Then Turgon sat in his high seat, holding his staff of doom, and in a stern voice spoke, I will not debate with you, dark elf. By the swords of the Noldor alone are your sunless woods defended. Your freedom to wander there wild you owe to my kin, and but for them long since you would have labored in thraldom in the pits of Angband. And here I am king, and whether you will it or will it not, my doom is law. This choice only is given to you, to abide here or to die here, and so also for your son. Now, what do you make of this? As I would say in my classes, let's do some analysis here. Tell me what you find interesting there. This is, you know, in some ways, this exchange really brings to the fore a bunch of the things that we were looking at in the last couple weeks, certainly about Sindar-Noldor relations here in Beleriand. What do you think, Laura?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I love Turgon's speech. I just think it's awesome. And Martin Shaw, I know he screws up the pronunciation, but he does a great job on this speech. It just sends chills up my spine to listen to him say this.
Oh, I agree.
But yeah. But I think Turgon, you know, and I love the speech, too. I just think it's the best thing that Turgon ever says. I just really like this, but it does kind of show the arrogance a little bit of the Noldor. By the swords of the Noldor alone are your sunless woods defended. It doesn't sound like they're really defending his woods in particular over mm-hmm. there. I guess they're sort of in the way of Morgoth, but it's not like they've really done much to defend him. You know, you see this giant clash of wills.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a nifty mix of it's like he's insulting him at the same time, right? Your sunless woods. He throws in there as well.
Well, that's the other thing that's interesting. Eol seems to be a hermit, more or less, but it seems like everybody knows exactly what's going on, which kind of puzzles me in this chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, let's keep hearing from people. Joe, what do you think?
I don't know. This is going to focus a bit more on Turgon, really, and how he's changed. Like, when you think back before he even went to Gondolin, like, people kind of gave him the rule out on the coast, and he kind of accepted it, but he didn't really claim it. And then when it comes to Gondolin, it's like he's changed quite a bit. And you can really see that here, like, the pride that he has and what he's saying. And, I'd say it's a good thing and a bad thing, probably, because he was the first one who really got along with everyone else. He was the first one that brought about the mingling of, like, the Sindar and everybody else.
Yes.
And now they're clashing hardcore, and I think that involves his pride, but also the pride of Eol. So, I don't know, I just thought that was interesting how you saw the transformation there, but then also how Eol was unwilling to cooperate.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not sure I would even say transformation, but I agree with you. At the very least, we're seeing the other side. And because you're right to say, Seth, like 3 weeks ago when we were talking about the description of Turgon and his people over in Nevrost, or maybe that was 2 weeks ago, and their first move to Gondolin, you're right. What we were emphasizing there was his wisdom and his humility, you know, that he was the one who most quickly and most completely mingled with the Sindar. And he's, but I don't think this is necessarily him changing so much as this is, we didn't see this side of Turgon before. But I'm not sure that it's completely contrary, to what we saw in him otherwise. Chris, what are you thinking?
There we go. I guess I just looked at it a little bit differently. First of all, Turgon offers the Ale a hand of friendship and pretty much gets spat on in return, at least figuratively. And so I guess I don't blame Turgon for being a little bit, it comes across as proud. I kind of agree with that, but I think it's maybe a little understandable. Plus the fact he's just kind of stating the facts. At this time, we're here. This is whether you like it or not, this is my kingdom and my word is law. Plus the fact Ale seems to be the exception as far as the Teleri goes. I think most of the other Teleri seem to be, if not delighted, at least acknowledge the benefit they get of the Noldor being there, and they are protecting them, whether they're actively doing it just for the Teleri or not. But that's the fact of it is that the Teleri's lands are being protected by the Noldor.
Right.
That's
right.
That's my two cents.
No, I think that's true. I mean, there is a kind of irony, right? We're told when we're introduced to Ael that he used to live in Doriath, but when Melian set the girdle up, he moved out. Because he didn't want to be living within the girdle of Melian. He didn't like that. He wanted to be on his own. He wanted to be a free agent. He wanted to be independent and clearly not beholden to anybody.
Now, does that remind us of as far as someone wanting to be totally alone and cut off from everybody else? It seems like the others have gone down that road and usually not to good result.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's easy to see Ael fitting part of a pattern here, right? Just like Feanor, just like Melkor, just like Saruman. Just like Sméagol. Whenever people separate themselves and want to distance themselves like that, it often does go bad. But I was saying, sort of, I think that the irony, right? He wants to be on his own. He wants to be independent. He wants to set up on his own and be beholden to no one. And yet, Turgon is making this point, which, as you say, is true. You know, you're over there setting up on your own and saying, I am my own master and I am, I have my own little realm here. Because the Noldor are keeping the orcs back. A, beat off the orcs that they found there, and B, it's behind the line of the siege. You know, they have the leaguer around Morgoth in the north. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, of course, it's not, and I don't even think Turgon is claiming, like, we are doing all of this for your benefit and you're so ungrateful. They're not doing it for his benefit in particular, but it is a fact that if it were not for the Noldor, the orcs would have already overrun him, and it doesn't look like he could stop them. At least he couldn't stop them the first time. So I think that there is a kind of irony. And that he seems to be, in a sense, genuinely fooling himself when he thinks that he is independent and that the Noldor are nothing but a nuisance, and worse than a nuisance. That's a rather slighting term to use to paraphrase his accusation.
You're right. He's kind of living in a little bit of a unrealistic dream world.
Yeah.
He's got his little realm in his woods, and he doesn't seem to see the big picture of what's really going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think it makes me think of the passages in the Council of Elrond when people talk about how, like when Boromir talks about how people don't appreciate what Gondor is doing on the front lines to keep back the enemy, and by their valor are all their lands protected, and Aragorn, says, well, the same is true about the Rangers, and he brings up, Butterbur and the people of Bree and how they're shielded from these things by the Rangers. And so it's almost like, the Bree people or the Shire folk rising up and saying, well, we are independent. We don't need you. And of course, that's kind of what they're doing, right? That's the point that Aragorn is making. Like they, the countrymen give us scornful names. That they are not just unappreciated. Now, I'm not trying to say exactly that the Noldor are in the same position as the Rangers here, because there is a self-consciously, self-sacrificial, sort of
altruistic action on the part of the Rangers, which the Noldor are not doing in the same way. But I think the parallel is kind of interesting, that he's kind of oblivious, like the people in Bree and in the Shire are oblivious to the danger that they would be in if they weren't protected. But he's much more malevolently oblivious.
And you know what? He's in a position. He's obviously intelligent. He should kind of in a position to know better. I mean, he totally twists everything, and maybe that's a part of his being alone and self-centered, that he kind of twists the logic of what's going on, or his interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, and one of the things I would notice in passing, you know, exchanges like this, it's something that I always find really interesting about Tolkien's dialogue and Tolkien's stories in moments like this. He is so good at sort of showing both sides. Cause, you know, you look at what Eol says and you can totally see. I mean, yeah, okay, he's a jerk, but you can see he's got points. You know, it's at least easy to sort of imagine yourself into his position and saying, you know, I can really see how he would look at it that way. And then, of course, then Turgon speaks and you're like, yeah, and I can see how he would look at it that way too. Tolkien is really good at sort of really showing and kind of doing justice to both sides of an argument. Mike, you've wanted to chip into this here for a while too.
I agree. I think that there are scenes that if you were going to try and make a Silmarillion movie as a director, you would put a check mark here and say, okay, I can see how this one would be filmed. I very much like Turgon standing and addressing Eol at the beginning of this exchange, hand extended, and then afterwards he sits back down and he's clutching his Staff of Doom, and I imagine him sort of, you know, squeezing it with greater and greater frustration as he's trying to respond to what Eol is saying. So I like the detail of him sitting back down, putting his hand down, and then grabbing that staff and then speaking in his stern voice. I also very much like Eol addressing Turgon, and at the end of his statement, basically turning to his son and saying, you've got to come back with me. And what this scene for me is really about is these two figures, Eol and Turgon, fighting over Maeglin. And Eol attempts to convince Maeglin to come back. And Turgon, at the end of his statement, rebuts that and says back to Eol, I'm the king here, and I'm going to pass judgment not only on you, but on your son as well. So I like the parallel of Eol making his statement to Maeglin, and then Turgon rebutting that statement about the son and who has authority over the son. And if you were filming this, it would be, you know, Eol standing in front of a seated Turgon, both of them arguing to each other, but ultimately arguing over Maeglin in the middle.
Yeah. No, I, and there, I think, is the place for me that jumps out most, as far as looking at the difference in perspective, the difference in attitude, the difference in character between Eol and Turgon here, is that possessiveness. I mean, when I was reading it, I couldn't help but emphasize, because I think they really stand out to me. But to claim my own, my wife and my son, those possessive pronouns, my son, you shall not withhold from me. He is claiming this absolute authority. My son and my wife, they are my possessions. And then, he sort of concedes, well, my wife is also your sister. So she's kind of half yours and half mine. So whatever, I'll concede that. But Maeglin is completely mine. And Turgon's response is to give Eol a choice and to give Maeglin a choice, right? This choice only is given to you, and so also for your son. And there's kind of contained there, it seems to me, a fairly gentle rebuke of Eol's attitude. Like, you know, your son here is not your possession. He has a choice to make too. And as king, I am going to give him a choice and let him make up his own mind. And of course, Eol's final move, you can see that's when he goes to kill Maeglin, with his javelin in the next paragraph at the top of the next page. Again, you can see the same emphasis. The second choice I take, and for my son also, you shall not hold what is mine, is sort of the ultimate statement of this this completely selfish and self-centered possessiveness. I will destroy them rather than see, I will destroy him rather than see anyone else possess him. Like Maeglin is this completely passive, object that he owns. It's, I think it's pretty remarkable. Jack?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right when you're saying that Tolkien can see both sides of an argument and have good points there. Because I can kind of see Turgon as being representing that big G government that Tolkien did not like, and Hale, you know, being the anarchist, the individualist that didn't want or need a boss ruling over him. And I don't think either of them necessarily are right or see the big picture, but Tolkien is able to present both sides of that argument through these characters. And another point I wanted to make quickly is that I can't help but feel that Eo represents the past of elves, in the sense that he's the dark elf. And since why is it an insult for an elf to be living in a sunless woods? Didn't all elves used to live in a sunless woods?
That's a really great point. I hadn't really ever thought about that line in that way, of course, but it's like, hey man, you know, it's like get with the times. It's we're in the era of the sun now, you know, like the, but yeah,
exactly.
The darkness of Eol, his connection with sunlessness is not necessarily, not intrinsically a bad thing. I mean, you know, elves and the starlight, that was the point, right? Now, I mean, at the same time, we have to be a little bit careful. I mean, of course, no other good guys cower away from the sun. I mean, Morgoth and his creatures cower away from the sun. It's not that Eol cowers away. It's not like he's like an orc. It's not like he can't operate by the sun or is damaged by the sun or weakened by the sun. He just doesn't like it, and he prefers to be abroad at night, and he prefers the sunless woods, as Turgon calls them. But so yeah, it's he's kind of ambiguously that I think is at least potentially not ambiguous. I think I mean ambivalent sort of signal about him, and this sort of leads me to a comment that I'd like to make. When he's called a dark elf, that's a really it's a peculiar kind of name, and something that I think can lead to a lot of confusion, because that word is used in several different senses, both in Tolkien and without. And I want to be careful when we think about sort of what it means when we call Eol a dark elf. For one thing, sometimes you'll remember that the elves are divided into two basic categories, two of the basic categories into which they're, one way in which to divide the elves, is into the categories of Moriquendi and Caliquendi, the elves of the darkness and the elves of the light. So in that sense, dark elves are any of the elves who didn't make it over to Valinor during the time of the trees. So all of the Sindar are in that sense dark elves. Sometimes the Avari, who did not come west at all to Valinor, who never set out on the journey, are called dark elves. But that's clearly not the sense in which dark elf is being used here. The way in which that name is kind of thrown at him, and we see it thrown at him twice by two very different characters. By Turgon, of course, in that speech that I read, "I will not debate with you, dark elf," but also in exactly the same tone by Curufin in the scene that Matt wants to read, which I want to do a little bit later. "What errand have you, dark elf, in my lands?" And now Curufin is a serious jerk, possibly only out-jerked by Carinthir among all of the sons of Feanor. And Turgon, of course, is wise and good and everything else. And yet both of them address him in that same way, dark elf, like that is in itself an insult. And they seem, of course, sorry, I just saw Mike's comment. No, we are not entitling this episode that. but anyway, yeah, so clearly they're connecting Eol with darkness, sort of moral darkness, you know, that they are saying that he is sort of sketchy in this way. And this sort of leads me to one of the other things that I wanted to say about that. One of the things that really muddies the waters is the fact that in a lot of other sort of fantasy worlds, and especially in various role-playing systems that have been derived directly or indirectly from Tolkien's works, you get separate evil species of elves like drow and things, which are dark-skinned and are called dark elves, both because they're physically darker and because they're evil and usually live underground. And that, of course, is just not reflected in Tolkien. There are no evil races of elves in Tolkien, so there are no dark elves in that way. And Eol is the closest thing we have to an elf who is evil and who is connected with, who is called dark elf and connected with evil in that way. But he's not, you know, he's not that different. He's got some issues. He's got some hang-ups, but, you know, he's not the only one with hang-ups. Feanor had some issues. Curufin has some issues. And we'll see those come out a little bit later. And of course his son Maeglin is gonna get himself into trouble. But anyway, so as I said, dark elf, it can just sound like that means he's evil, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. I think it's sort of tends to be used in a sort of a comparatively neutral way, in this, like he's an elf who is in the darkness, but with him in particular, it is clear that there is a moral darkness associated with him as well. Jack, did you have something else you wanted to add here?
Yeah, just one thing is that I think Tolkien sometimes gets unjustly criticized for everything just being black and white. And I don't think that's true, and I think this is one of those passages where things are kind of gray.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, and this is a really good moment. This whole exchange between Turgon and Eol, and the way that you really can see both sides of it, and even the guy who is clearly the bad guy, and the guy who's clearly the good guy. The guy who's clearly the bad guy, you can look at and say, well, you know, he's kind of got an argument in some ways. And the guy who is clearly the good guy, you look at him and be like, oh, you can see this guy's, you know, there are some issues here. I think that's really definitely true. It's kind of rare, actually, in Tolkien's works to have, you know, this sort of unambiguous, shining, resplendent good character, especially. There are some characters who are pretty unambiguously evil, but it's much more unusual. And of course, even there, you know, you'll still get reminders like Elrond's reminder in the Council of Elrond, that, you know, nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. But yet certainly with the good guys, there are very few good guys who have no hang-ups, who have no moments, who have no issues. And in the Silmarillion, even more so, I think, than in the Lord of the Rings. But yeah, no, good. I think I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I agree, and I think that that's really an important thing. An important misperception, I think, of Tolkien's works. Dave, you were mentioning before that you were, would you still like to make a defense of some of Eol's comments here? I think we haven't quite done justice to, and I know in the text chat, you were supporting Eol and his initial claims there. You want to defend the dark elf here?
Sure, why not? I find him just to be sort of a tragic character. It's hard to say he's the good guy here. He did kidnap Turgon's sister, which was pretty crappy. And he's pretty awful about, like, he doesn't exactly, I mean, I'm projecting my modern mores onto this, but he doesn't appear to treat her or his son particularly well. He's not a horrible guy. On the other hand, I just, you know, I feel bad for him, because, or I find him to be a tragic character, because I sort of, that that, of course, this could be my own personal biases, but the idea that there's the Noldor has sort of come in to this land that other people lived in for a long time and implanted themselves and set up little kingdoms and drawn up boundaries and then decided that they get to make the rules and conducted themselves in sort of a very sort of haughty way is annoying, to say the least. And you sort of feel for Eol that his freedom and his liberty are being taken away from him because of, by the Turgon and by the elves of Gondolin. Now, nobody's told him to sneak in there, but they didn't. It's not like there was sort of a general warning, like, hey, don't come in here if you want to come out again. I think it's just an incredibly nuanced and complicated situation. Because on the other hand, you understand why Turgon's doing it. And it's not like he went to, over to Eol's home and imposed himself there. I mean, he picked a place nobody else was living, nobody else wanted to live. And he drew up, you know, he built it up and he made his own rules. And so, you know, it's sort of like they say about Theoden, a king will have his own way in his own court. But still, I'm not saying that he should have let Eol go away, because he has reasons for what he does. And I'm not saying Eol's even a particularly sympathetic guy, but I think he's a tragic guy. Like, the end that he meets is pretty awful. The decisions that he makes are pretty awful. The situation that he found himself in was pretty awful. And so it's just kind of tragic. And at the end of the day, I don't find Turgon to be, he's not conducting himself in a particularly heroic way. And in the end, everything that he's built up gets destroyed. And where does his sword end up? Well, it ends up in the treasure of a bunch of trolls. So I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of particularly heroic individuals in this set of events, other than ultimately like people like Glorfindel and Húrin and Húr and Túr. Turgon is kind of, I don't know, he's a very mixed character at this point. I'm not saying he's a bad guy, but I certainly can see Eol's point of view.
Yeah, no, I mean, two things quickly that I would comment on or sort of emphasize, because I think are really important. That first, there is, I think that the thing to me which most undermines Eol's position, if he were called, you know, say before the Sons of Feanor, for instance, and he were there making his protest about, you know, the imperialism of the Noldor, you know, he'd have a little bit more of a point, especially since the Sons of Feanor are mostly jerks. But he, you know, talking to, you know, saying exactly the things that he says to Turgon, of all people, you know, that, you know, you have no right or any of your kin to seize lands or realms or to set bounds here or there. He's not set arbitrary, but I mean, he, of all of the Noldor, Turgon is least guilty of this, right? I mean, he's the one who embraced the Teleri, and the Teleri embraced him, and then he moved to a completely unoccupied, indeed wholly undiscovered land and built a city there. If there's anybody who is displacing nobody, it's Turgon, right? So there's a kind of irony there. But I also, I agree with you about the tragedy of Eol, that he is in a sense a tragic character, especially since we can see he has a certain degree of stature. He is a powerful figure. He has real potential to be good, real potential to do great things. We will find he is a really great smith. He's one of the legendary smiths. He is the one who forges the Black Sword, which is going to be such a prominent character in the story of Túrin Túrinbar. And even, you know, the other thing that I would point to that we haven't mentioned at all is his connection with the dwarves, which I think is really interesting, and I think is one of the kind of, in a sense, possibly most attractive things about Eol. But the thing that I would qualify, the way that I would qualify, Dave, your point about the tragedy of his character, is that his tragedy is also self-imposed. That is, he's not marginalized, he's not being forced into anything. He is marginalizing himself, he is sort of restricting himself. If he is a you know, a person of great power and of great potential who is going bad or going wrong or going to waste, it's also kind of his fault. And we see, again, like Saruman, like, you know, like Feanor, like others of great gifts and of great, great potential who just don't make good choices with that. There is something tragic in that, just as, you know, we recall the scene of the Valar, Manwë weeping over the marring of Feanor. Almost as much as for the darkening of Valinor and the destruction of the trees. And I think that, you know, we can see, there is an aspect of that with Eol, but with Eol, as with Feanor, it doesn't mean it isn't his fault. Jordan, I think you want to, reply to Dave, I'm guessing?
Yes, I absolutely do. First of all, when Dave says that he doesn't treat his son very well, I'd call attempted murder a little bit worse than not very well. I'd say he's pretty awful to his son and tells him he can't leave along with the wife and they have to sneak away. Second of all, Eol is warned that if he seeks after them, he won't come home. So it's not like, you know, he just goes into Gondolin and then is like, oh no, I'm not gonna make it out. He knows going in, he's not coming out of there alive, but does it anyway. Third of all, Turgon is completely right. His land doesn't exist without the Noldor keeping the leaguer of Morgoth, so he has no right to come in and demand things of Turgon in the Hidden Kingdom, and it's absolutely Turgon's right to have laws that say you cannot leave because clearly Eol is completely unstable, and if he does leave, Morgoth's going to find Gondolin. 100% Turgon, absolutely.
you certainly make some good points there. I mean, there's no question that I think it's hard to disagree with the fact that letting Eol go is kind of not an option here. I mean, talk about somebody who's not going to need to be asked twice to betray Gondolin.
So that's why I would say that it's kind of a tragedy of circumstances, as it were. You know what I mean? And he's certainly right. The fact that Eol decides at the end, not just that, like, okay, fine, kill me, but that he attempts to kill like his own son. I mean, that's pretty awful. You're right about that, Jordan. In the end, he makes the wrong decision, and he gets what he deserves. The fact that he would choose to kill his own son rather than like let his own son stay if his son wants to, that's pretty obviously wrong. That's indefensible. It's indefensible. But it's just sort of the tragedy is the manner with which the elves treat each other here. The fact that Eol would come in and make demands, and then the fact that Turgon like doesn't seem terribly sympathetic to the fact that Eol probably wouldn't be too happy being penned up here. I mean, his own sister wanted to leave Gondolin, for God's sake. And maybe just this idea that no one ever leaves was just untenable to begin with. And of course, it turned out to be, because after all, who is it that ends up screwing them over? That's right, Maeglin. And so maybe Gondolin was just doomed to fall apart from the very, ultimately. And to some extent, this sort of policy, it's not to say Turgon's policy here with Eol is wrong, that he should have let him leave. But ultimately, Turgon's sort of idea that somehow he can keep Gondolin a secret, somehow that he can preserve it, fails. And sort of his unwillingness to accept that that's true is what ends up allowing Gondolin to be destroyed. And so maybe it was just a bad policy to begin with. Even if he does have the right. I'm not convinced he has the right to do that, to impede Eol's liberty here, but even if he does, it ends up failing and the whole thing falls apart and blows up and they're totally unprepared for an invasion because they never expected anyone would be able to leave.
Yeah. Joe, you wanted to bring a different angle in here.
Yeah, and I want to add a disclaimer. I'm much more on the Jordan side on this, but so this isn't really a defense of of anybody, but it just seems like couldn't you say the curse is working here? And I'm gonna connect this with what Dave said. There's always choices that can be made. I mean, say Maeglin never betrayed anybody. Well, then Gondolin would have lasted longer, but the beautiful things wouldn't have come, like Arendil, like getting the Silmaril and doing all that wonderful stuff. So anyway, this is a disaster. But
well, you were talking about the curse and the connection between the curse and choices.
Yeah. Okay,
which
because I was going to add on to it with what Dave said, so now I'm just going to go back to what I was saying. Basically, I think that the curse was acting on him somewhat, but then again, his own choices came into effect. Because, I mean, the curse of the Noldor is ultimately going to drive things, it seems, but, I mean, as you see with other examples throughout the Silmarillion, I mean, it's always people just making bad decisions also that helps drive that. And, I mean, so it's not really a defense of him, but, I mean, you can tell that there's other forces acting here as well.
I agree. You know, and that, I think, is one of the really interesting things to think about here. Because on the one hand, you can look at this story and you can see the whole thing. This is a series of choices that people have made, and the stuff that happens, the bad stuff that happens, is all of it the consequences of bad choices that people made. You know, Arathel did not act really well. We haven't talked about her much. I want to come back to her in a little bit. You know, and then we've got Maeglin making some dubious choices, and we've got Eol making some pretty bad choices, and we've got Turgon acting in ways which not everyone's entirely approving of here at the end. And yet, at the same time, you know, again, coming back to one of the things that Dave was saying, we have this overall sense of, you know, like, when you kind of step back and look at it, even though you can see point by point all of the individual choices that are being made and how each thing follows from the other, when you step back and look at this whole situation, it's really easy to see, man, yeah, look at the Curse of Mandos at work here. You see how this, because of course, one of the primary things that Eol cites is not just the imperialism of the Noldor, but he brings up the kinslaying. You know, he is big on the, you know, he's a very, very, very pro-Teleri, you know, anti-Sons of Feanor, really bent out of shape still about the kinslaying kind of perspective here. And again, it goes straight back to the Curse of the Noldor. Now there will be division. Now you will not be able to trust each other. And Eol is so antagonistic to Turgon because of the kinslaying, but also, you know, Turgon is wise not to trust him. And again, remember, not being able to trust each other for fear of treachery was exactly what the Curse of Mandos was about. So I think it's really cool to see the way these things all work together. I think I mentioned once before when we were talking about the Ainur Lindoleh that I think that Tolkien's depiction of creation in the Ainur Lindoleh is one of the most elegant literary treatments of the way that that predestination and free will work together, that you have the providential plan of God being worked out through the individual choices of the free moral agents, and that the moral agents are genuinely free, and yet the plan being formed is God's plan. Like, that's, you know, that's an old medieval idea, that is the idea that those two things operate at the same time. And as I said a long time ago, I think that we can see Tolkien articulating that. But at the same time, I think you can see it in moments like this too. And I think it's pretty. I think that's pretty cool. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry if somebody has already said this, but it just struck me sort of the parallels between Eol and Turgon in what's her name? I can't remember her name now. Now I'm forgetting. Arathel, is that how you say it?
Arathel, yeah. The DH is the voiced the. So, yeah. Okay. Arathel, yeah.
When Arathel comes to Eol's little country, he keeps her there and he doesn't let her leave. In the way he set up his own little small version of Gondolin, he's trying to stay in control. He's trying to fence out not only the Noldor and the orcs and, you know, everything that threatens him in sort of a petty way compared to what Turgon is doing. But in a way, it's parallel, too. You know, they both are trying to keep this absolute control over this little area of land, and in the end, it's going to be pointless because it's all going to go. But for the time they have, they both want to keep that control. And then when Eol finds out where his wife and son have gone and finds they're under the control of somebody with an even bigger land than he's got, it's just ironic that, you know, Turgon wants to keep Arathel and Maeglin in Gondolin, just the same way that Aeol wanted to keep them there in his little country.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, and Laura, that is actually the number one thing that I was thinking. You know, it's every time I read almost any of Tolkien's books, you know, I feel like I always notice something new and or sort of think about something from a new angle. And that was totally the one that I was thinking of this time in reading this chapter. That is the parallel. And I'd never thought about this at all before. But the parallel between Nan Elmoth, where Aeol lives, and Gondolin, that you have not only this direct parallel, both of them highly insular, no contact with anybody else. Of course, it's not like Turgon is living by himself. I mean, he's got a whole bunch of people in there with him. But anyway, this isolated group, Aeol isn't alone either. He's got servants and people living with him, and he hangs out with dwarves. But anyway, they're isolated, and yet they're also opposites, right? You have the City of Shining Light, and you have the, you know, the House of Darkness in the middle of the Sunless Woods. So they're both parallel and they're opposite. But, you know, and certainly Aeol sounds kind of hypocritical when he's like, who are you to tell me I can't leave? And, you know, one could say, like, you know, if I were Maeglin, I'd be tempted to say the same thing. Yeah, who are you to say that I can't leave? Like, okay, I mean, yeah, you're my dad and everything, but, you know, we're not your chattel. And he treats them like his chattel. And I think when we compare, I mean, both of them have pass rules, that is, both Turgon and Aeol, pass rules that the people who come to their house can't leave. I mean, you want to talk about, saw again before people were talking about, you know, the Gondolin as like the elf motel that you go in, you know, the elves go in and they can never come out again. Aeol's house is much more like that. You know, as he leads her by, you know, he's sort of luring her in, it's very much like a trap. He sees her going by and thinks she's really attractive, and so he sort of steers her in and guides her until she shows up at his house, and then he shows up at the door and is like, hey, you know, so, and then won't let her leave. So, forbids her ever to leave again. Even to, you know, to, I mean, I understand whatever the he doesn't like the Sons of Feanor, but anyway, his possessiveness, and I keep coming back to possessiveness here, because when you compare those two rules, that is Aeol, ruling over his house, and Turgon ruling over his realm, and both of them bringing people in, well, or when people come in, not letting them go again. To me, Aeol sounds much pettier in comparison. Turgon is wise to do what he does. The thing that is protecting Gondolin primarily is its secrecy. And so he is setting up this guarded realm, this hidden realm, at the advice of Olmo. Remember, this wasn't even his idea. Olmo said, build this place, which will be secret from everybody else, and keep it secret. And Olmo guarded them and protected them and shielded them so nobody saw the whole nation of people migrating into this place. But Aeol has no motivation for not letting people leave other than possessiveness, other than you're my wife and you're my son and I'm not going to share you with anybody and you got to do what I say. And that's, I mean, he's the one who is the arbitrary tyrant. Turgon, you know, Aeol is speaking to him like he's a tyrant, but even if you think Turgon's a tyrant, he's not an arbitrary tyrant. I find that parallel really suggestive when you think about Aeol's house and Turgon's country, in parallel with each other. He makes the crack, Aeol makes that crack about, you know, the bird going back to the cage where it sickened before. But, you know, again, if he's right, if they're both cages, at least, boy, that's a serious upgrade going back to the nice cage. I mean, there's that moment when Arathel comes back and her perspective has been rather renewed by hanging out in the dark house of Aeol for a long time. And she's like, actually, it's kind of nice here. Anyway, let's go back to Arathel. because we haven't talked about her much, and she is she's a pretty major character here. And I mean, I say that just because, you know, this is one of the only times in the Silmarillion, and not the only time, but this is a noteworthy time when we get a prominent female character acting very independently and really sort of striking out on her own. She's not the only one we'll see by any means, but she's one of the first ones that we've seen. And John, way back at the beginning, I think was right to make the connection to Galadriel. The reference we have to Galadriel's desire to rule realms at her own will is very short. You know, of course we talked about it when we did that chapter, but I agree, there is a kind of that kind of independence. I don't think that her motivation is exactly the same as Galadriel here, but certainly that the degree of strength and independence that she shows. Arathel, we will recall, she is the cousin of Galadriel, their first cousins, and the two of them, yeah, they're the only female grandchildren of Finwë, the two of them? Yeah, I think that's true. Arathel and Galadriel. So there are several reasons why we could or should compare them. What do you guys think? Joe, did you have Arathel thoughts?
Yeah, but it's not really on the same note, like, as you were going. This is kind of branching into something else. So if someone else wants to talk on that, they can. You can just come back to me.
Okay, sure. Laura?
Arathel seems to be somebody who, for an elf anyway, seems to be blown about by the wind. She seems a bit capricious. And where it said that she was fearless at one point, I kept thinking, she's not fearless, she's foolish. I mean, she should know better after all the experiences the elves have had, that the world is dangerous and you don't just go take a jaunt and try to sneak past Morgoth and just because you feel like you need to get out. You know, that's kind of how I saw her. I just thought that she was kind of fickle, especially compared to the other elves we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, fickle's a harsh word, but I agree. I mean, you can see that. I mean, even the way in which she's like, oh, Gondolin, I'm so bored here. And then she leaves and she's like, oh, Eol's house, I'm so bored here. I wish I were back in Gondolin. I mean, it's certainly easy to think in those terms. And I agree about her foolishness. I mean, it's important to keep in mind. You know, she is not, one might be tempted to think of Arathel as a, you know, like a sheltered person, you know, she lives in Gondolin, she doesn't know the world. She knows the world. She crossed the Helcaraxa, of course. I mean, she was there. She endured, you know, one of the greatest, you know, and most bitter trials ever endured by the elves. So, she's no, she's no sheltered and naive, girl here. You know, we shouldn't be imagining her as like, you know, a young teenager or something like that. I mean, it's, but I agree. I mean, foolishness, she certainly does seem kind of foolish. Mike?
Choose a slightly different adjective. Instead of foolish, I would choose restless. And that's an adjective that's ascribed to her in this chapter. And I think one of the, you know, morals of the chapter, going back to what we touched on, is when you have immortal beings like elves, some of them will be restless, like this character. And when you put them in situations where they're walled in, that's not sustainable.
Yeah, and you know, I have to think, to some extent, it's hard not to see Arathel and her restlessness as at least a little bit, well, if not an indictment of Gondolin, at least a question mark, right? I mean, we were already looking last time at, you know, Gondolin and Turgon's motivations for Gondolin and how he sets up Gondolin, and it's backwards looking, and it's you know, memorial of, you know, it's little, you know, its role as a memory of Tirion upon Tuna. But he, you know, and so there are questions there, like, is that totally okay? You know, is there something, you know, is there something questionable? Is this really an entirely good idea? And I think Arathel kind of suggests, you know, it's certainly prudent to live in there and to stay in there and not to come out and never to let anybody out. There's no question that that's wise in the sense of being smart, in the sense of being prudent. But yeah, I'm not sure it's in, we can see with Arathel, Arathel's desire to see her kinsmen and friends. I mean, on the one hand, it might seem like, oh, look, she has, you know, dodgy friends, you know, and that she wants to hang out with Kelegorm and Curufin. But remember, Fingon was close friends with Mithros too, and that was a great thing. And if we see, again, it's tempting. I think one can read Arathel's desire to go and hang out with the, you know, like with the dangerous bad boys on the other side of the mountains as like, you know, a teenage girl rebelling against her parents. And I don't think that that's, if instead of looking at it that way, we look at it as in some sense, at least potentially, a kind of mini reprise of the friendship which led Fingon to go and rescue Mithros from where he was stapled to the side of Thangorodrim. I mean, that's not a bad thing. And certainly building bonds and those bonds of friendship are not bad. And it does, I think, kind of draw, it does bring Turgon and the whole Gondolin plan into question at least a tiny little bit. You're isolating yourselves. You're disconnecting yourselves from everybody. You are breaking these bonds, these relationships, and you are severing them. You're de facto severing them. If we were talking about it's being kind of questionable, pretty obviously questionable, the way that Aeol separates himself from the society of the rest of Doriath and from almost everybody's society. If that's kind of sketchy, if that's kind of Saruman-like, well, what about Turgon? I mean, no, he's not doing it for Saruman's motivations. He's not doing it for Aeol's motivations, but he is also isolating himself. And I think that that's not an unambiguously good thing. Again, I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm not saying that, you know, Gondolin is corrupt from the beginning, but there, from the beginning, we have these seeds planted, these sort of question marks planted. Mike, did you want to respond back again?
Just to add to that, her nature seems to be restless, exploratory. Some of the descriptions seem to be how we've heard men described, yearning to wander free, restless, looking to ride further abroad, seeking for new paths, untrodden glades. So if you know, certain elves will have that character. And if you have a fortress city, those two ideas are going to come into conflict.
Yeah. 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 No, I agree. I mean, and again, you think even back to the question marks we were talking about not only Turgon's Gondolin plan, but the Valar's, Valinor plan and bringing the elves over there. The elves, their purpose was to wander freely around Middle Earth, right? So, if what the Valar did was not clearly an unambiguously good thing, I think that we can say what Turgon is doing is also not an unambiguously good thing. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to get anybody else's impression now and how this might fit into her personality. Aeol apparently traps her in his realm, and he took her to wife, and then it says a little later that she was not wholly unwilling. And I'm trying to picture this scenario as far as, you know, how did that really come about? Did he force her? Did he use his power of his voice like Feanor might? Or is she a free spirit and just thought, hey, what the heck? That's not very elf-like, but I guess I don't quite know what to make of how that might have come about. I just wondered what anybody else thought.
Yeah, trivia question. Relevant trivia question. The piece of forest where Aeol now has his home. You remember who else we have met there? What else happened there in that place?
Thingol and Melian.
Exactly. That's where Thingol met Melian. So there's a kind of parallel there where you have, yep, like guy who is marrying up, guy who is wandering, or in this case, it's the girl who's wandering in Nan Elmoth, and he sees her and is like, whoa. Now he doesn't have the Thingol experience where he stands there saying like, whoa, for, you know, centuries or whatever in a, you know, this sort of suspended animation that Thingol is in. But, And of course, his reaction is very different, and you have him in this sort of predator mode of, you know, drawing her into the house, you know, luring and drawing her into his house until he has her there and then keeps her. Yeah, it does not sound, or rather, I'll say it a different way. It sounds as if Tolkien is not wanting us to imagine this as like a rape, like he has trapped her and is taking her by force. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say his comment about her not being wholly unwilling kind of seems an effort to do that, but the way it's the description leading up to it, it's hard not to assume rape. I guess that's my thinking about it. And you're right, that following line, it almost doesn't fit. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, no. And the thing that I would emphasize too is there's this kind of funny indirection that Tolkien uses in his language. It is not said that Arathel was wholly unwilling. That's two huge steps removed from saying Arathel was willing, right? We're not saying that Arathel was willing. We're saying Arathel was not wholly unwilling. And we're not even just saying Arathel was not wholly unwilling. We're saying it's not said that she's not wholly unwilling. So the sort of the heaps of negatives that are being placed on this here sort of does certainly convey the fact that she's not enormous. This is not love at first sight. This is not, you know, a fairy tale romance from Arathel's standpoint. Whereas, of course, Thingol and Melian exactly is a fairy tale romance, right? You have this. What I think is a really interesting, interesting contrast between the two of them, between those two relationships. But yeah, as like what we're supposed to take about how legit this is, both Turgon and more gently Turgon and less gently Curufin talk about how, well, basically that Eol was clearly in the wrong, that what he did in their eyes is more like kidnapping than it is like marriage proposal, right? No customs were followed. He has not joined himself to her family. He has merely taken her away from her family and kept her away from her family. And that seems a sort of a dodgy thing. But we've wandered here away from Arathel herself here a bit. Joe, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Well, this is really relating to her act of selflessness when she jumps in front of the spear. That is a really good thing. But just the course of events that happen after that, like what it leads to eventually, something very bad happening to Gondolin. I mean, it's interesting how an act of selflessness leads to something really bad happening. Usually it's the opposite. But then again, I mean, who knows what would have happened if she wouldn't have done that? If she sort of stood there shocked, and I mean, who knows? Maybe she would have ran off crazed and gotten out and told everyone where Gondolin was. Who knows? But I just thought it was interesting just how all these together, maybe that ties back into the curse, just a course of events that just roll onto each other, play off of each other. Because you just don't see that very often. Of course, you wouldn't know it unless you've read the book the rest of the way either, so maybe I'm looking too deeply into it. But
I agree. I do think that that is an important point. It is interesting that certainly throwing yourself in front of a javelin aimed at somebody else, and certainly a mother throwing herself in the path of a javelin aimed at her son, that seems like, as you say, that seems like a really unambiguously good action. And yet it is, at the very least, it's really ironic that that the consequence of this is bad. That in the end, looking back on it, there, I bet, are going to be many who would wish that Maeglin took the spear that day. Laura, I was thinking exactly what you just typed. We've talked almost not at all about Maeglin himself, and we really need to do that before we run out of time here. What do you guys make of Maeglin? He, I think, is the description of him is fascinating. His silence, his watching, he is someone who is so obviously thinking much more than he says, much more than he actually lets out. But yeah, Mike, what are you thinking about?
Those two observations are that one, Aol the father is stooped and crooked from his smith work. He's bent from working with ore and iron. But his son, Maeglin, is described at the end of the chapter as being psychologically crooked or psychologically bent. And I very much like the parallel of the father to the son and the fact that the father, you know, is described as being sort of bent up and crooked and twisted physically, but the son in Idril observing him is described as being sort of crooked on the inside in a kind of deviant and dangerous way. And I also very much like the fact that he's described as a mind reader who hides his own mind from others.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, he is, it makes me think of the description that Treebeard gives of Saruman's eyes, right? That, you know, sort of the closed doors behind his eyes. Yeah, no, I think that's a brilliant point, Mike. And, I think that we can see it is tempting. Certainly when you're reading this for the first time, you know, Joe, as you were just recognizing, not knowing for sure exactly what's going to happen later on, it might be tempting to look at Maeglin and say, oh, he's inherited some unfortunate bad traits from his dad, but he's like a better version, or maybe he could be like the redemption of Aeol. You know, it's like he has the potential. Now he's going to be raised in Gondolin, in the City of Light, instead of the House of Darkness. So hooray! You know, he can fulfill what Aeol failed. You know, he can be like the non-tragic version. But I think, you know, that as you point out, Mike, we can see in that language, not at all, that he is in fact, that Aeol's crookedness was superficial compared to Maeglin's crookedness. And I think that is pretty clear. Laura, go ahead.
I just want to make an observation that, Maeglin, is both a high kin of the Teleri. He's noble from the noble house of the Teleri and the noble house of the Noldor. So he's actually combining these two different elf races, and that's where the poison comes from, or this evil that's coming into Gondolin. That's where it comes from. It comes from both the Teleri and the Noldor. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. Instead of just coming from the Noldor, the Teleri are also brought into this.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, it's ironic, right? I mean, you would think, like in theory, wouldn't he be like the sort of the poster child of the Gondolindrim, right? I mean, this is what the Gondolindrim are like. You know, it's the ultimate blending of Noldor and Teleri. This is going to be great, except not really.
Yeah, it's almost like the fall of Feanor or of Melkor, you know, that what could be the best and brightest has the biggest fall, too.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And when we have, of course, it will be for that, or this will be a really good thing to remember when we get back to the fall of Gondolin later on, because, of course, the one who is going to be poised against him on the other side is going to be Huor, of course, but also Eärendil, the one who is half-elf, half-human. So you've got, you know, sort of the one who is going to fulfill the potential of sort of the joining of two kindreds, and the one who is failing, but does kind of by sort of structure have this potential to join, to be the joining of two kindreds like that. I mean, even thinking, we haven't talked about Thingol at all. Not that he's much of a character in this, but you see his turning back, or by his orders, turning back of Arathel at the border. You know, there are bridges to be built here. You know, that would be nice, actually, to help to build those bridges more between the Noldor and Thingol. And yeah, Maeglin could theoretically do. Oh no, wait, he can't. He's stuck in Gondolin now and can't leave anymore. I guess diplomacy, not really an option. Oh, well, never mind. Other thoughts about Maeglin? Notice his first motivation to go to Gondolin. It seems like a good thing at first. You know, he loves to hear her stories about Gondolin. And again, it sort of it has this really attractive setup, right? Like, he's the one who is, you know, we get these pictures of him. They're just, you know, enthralled by his mom's stories of Gondolin. And so you can see, you know, I talked about Gondolin being this mythic, concept in the Third Age. You know, you can see to Maeglin that it's like a mythic concept already in the First Age when it's barely been built. And, you know, so it's like, you know, him was, you know, tell me about Gondolin and the beauty of Gondolin again. And even sort of, you know, the wistfulness of that. Here we are stuck in this dark, gloomy house. You know, tell me about the lights. Tell me about the fountains. Tell me about the gold and silver trees. And it seems like potentially kind of moving and kind of beautiful. But what does he like about it? What's his favorite part of the story? Do you remember his favorite part of the story?
That there's no heir to Gondolin.
yeah, that's for him the thing. And my favorite part about all these stories is that I could take over someday. You know, I mean, he that's crooked. He is crooked. His love and appreciation of things. You know, and again, you can see that when Arathel comes back, and we get in all three of them, in Eol and in Maeglin and in Arathel, this reaction to being in Gondolin for the first time for the two of them and back in Gondolin for the other. And that is, you know, they're all astonished. You know, they're all three of them, you know, and Arathel is thinking like, oh, wow, this is so beautiful. Why did I ever want to leave? This is so great. Maeglin and Eol being, you know, like, whoa, this is pretty incredible. And it making Eol more bitter. Maeglin has a different reaction, right? He's looking around and thinking, you know, and one day all of this could be mine. Chris?
A little bit about his attraction to Idril. Was it all a physical attraction, or was it the fact that if he married her, I mean, if it was allowed to marry her, then he would be the legitimate heir of Turgon, rather.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, we are told that he has a genuine, like, star-crossed love for her. I mean, when this is introduced to us there in that last long paragraph, for from his first days in Gondolin he had borne a grief ever worsening that robbed him of all joy. He loved the beauty of Idril and desired her without hope. So he does seem to, you know, he does have this, like, tragic love thing going on, But Chris, there's no question. We know from the beginning that he was motivated, that the lack of an heir thing was what he was really attracted by. And there's no question, from a purely objective, you know, from a purely Machiavellian standpoint, the right thing to do, the smart thing to do to solidify his political position would be to marry Idril, because she is in this, she is in this kind of, at least potentially, ambiguous political place. Does she inherit? She's his only child, and she's going to be his only child because his wife is dead. So does she inherit, or does it go to Maeglin, his nephew? You know, direct child or nearest male heir? Where does it go? Well, hey, you know, solve this problem. Let's get together. You know, and I will marry her, and then there can be no question. Then I will be his nephew and his son-in-law, and everything will definitely come to me. And again, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to not think about it in those terms. Again, we are told to believe that he actually does love her. You know, has this tragic infatuation with her, but.
Think both can be true. I mean, because of his motivations of his whole dream of Gondolin not having an heir, and then he falls for her, those two go hand in hand and can both be true.
Yeah. No, I, and especially since we get that last, you know, we've had all of this talk about his plotting and how much he wants power and how he would really, and, you know, sort of his desire to go and to establish himself, as the heir of Gondolin. And therefore, I think it's really impossible not to see, not to see this in that context. And we're reminded of that later on, you know, at the end of that same paragraph. But as the years passed, still Maeglin watched Idril and waited, and his love turned to darkness in his heart, and he sought the more to have his will in other matters, shirking no toil or burden if he might thereby have power. But this is not a question of, like, oh, it's only because he would... If Idril had just said yes, then he would not have gone over to the dark side, and he would, he would not be seeking power. He was clearly seeking power before. That was obviously motivating him pretty much from the beginning. Joe?
I was just going to say, you can kind of see how selflessness isn't always a good thing, that motivation behind it affects it, because, you know, as you said, is that he didn't shirk any task. I mean, you know, he kind of did whatever to gain power. So, I mean, he was putting himself on the line to do those things, but strictly for himself. Now, Arathel, I don't think her motivations were quite the same as that, but I just thought it was interesting how you can see the two different sides of selflessness, and I guess one really isn't selflessness, but almost.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, and even just thinking about it in terms of his being the work that he does. I mean, as you say, the work that he pours into, and it's not selfless in the sense that we're told that it has selfish motivation. He seeks by doing these things to get power. But at the same time, you know, isn't it interesting? Both Aeol and Maeglin are both smiths and miners, not just being like dwarfs, but hey, guess what? They're sub-creators again. Aeol, certainly, even more so than Maeglin, is yet another sub-creator gone bad. He is a great smith. He is a great craftsman. And again, with him, unlike Feanor, for instance, his smithcraft, his sub-creating, isn't what seems to lead him astray. It has nothing to do with that. But again, possessiveness, that same kind of possessiveness was certainly, just thinking about it from that angle is certainly like Feanor. Just doesn't seem to be a coincidence that he also is another sub-creator, yet another artist. Let's see, one of you were, Brandon, you quoted my favorite passage from that. Idril loved Maeglin not at all, right? That is, such an elegant piece of understatement. And that too is interesting. Idril, we learn very little about Idril here in this chapter. Unlike her aunt Arathel, she is not a major character. She is, she is a kind of, in a sense, a central figure who keeps coming up, but she is not, we don't see her doing anything. But this one thing that we see of her, this one action that she does, this sort of negative action, it's a positive action. She sees through Maeglin, and appears to be the only one who does, far more than her dad. We will see Turgon relying on Maeglin and trusting him. And it seems that Idril's not fooled, and is pretty dubious about it from the beginning. And that shows some real wisdom in her, superior wisdom, as I said, even to her dad's. Mike?
This chapter is called Of Maeglin, and I'm wondering, does he have a single line of dialogue that he actually says in this chapter?
That is a really great point. But Maeglin, looking upon his father, was silent. But Maeglin answered nothing. He's significantly silent on several occasions. Does that count?
Well, I see where he's significantly silent, but I think it's... I was just skimming very quickly. I don't think he has a single line of dialogue, and in noticing that, I think that's a pretty cool way to sort of up the ante on his sinister slash silent character, or nature, I should say.
Yes.
He does have one line.
Good, yeah, I just found it too. Go ahead.
Therefore he said to Arathel, "Lady, let us depart while there is time. What hope is there in this wood for you or for me? Here we are held in bondage, and no profit shall I find here. For I have learned all that my father has to teach, or that the Nalgrim will reveal to me. Shall we not seek for Gondolin? You shall be my guide, and I will be your guard."
Yeah, yeah. His, but I, do think that's it. And certainly when we get to the crucial moments when people are giving really memorable speeches, at the end, he doesn't get any. In fact, all we get from him is nothing. And even, you know, looking at the two speeches that we were looking at for so long before, that is Aeol's speech and Turgon's speech, we were kind of glancing over the fact that the pivot point between the two is Maeglin's science, but Maeglin answered nothing. It wasn't Turgon's turn to speak, in a sense. Maeglin might have spoken, might have said something. Here, he does not speak up. On behalf of his father, he does not join his father, nor does he oppose his father. He merely says nothing and lets Turgon answer him. And then, when he is explicitly appealed to, he's been attacked and everything, surely now this is the place for him to give a speech, right? But he doesn't give a speech either.
So I guess he doesn't need to say anything, since as a mind reader he can read the secrets of hearts beyond the mist of words.
Well, yeah, because all giving a speech might do is let on to other people what you're thinking. What's the point of that, right? I do think that it is important, his conspicuous silence, especially in that last exchange, is very interesting. Though, of course, it also reminds me of the other time we see Idril doing anything in this chapter, and that is she, with Aradhel, are moving Turgon to have mercy on Aeol, even after he, you know, does his javelin thing. But the pleas of Idril... So Idril is not just, you know, against them from the beginning. She argues that Aeol's life should be spared, but yet she's obviously not blind, and not blinded to Maeglin's problems, or rather the problem that he is. Javelin and dart are synonyms, Mike. Dart is a pretty generic word. Dart doesn't mean a thing that you throw in a pub. The word dart, it can be used as a synonym for javelin, for arrow, for pretty much any pointy thing that flies through the air. So that's this. Not a problem. Do we want to read our passage, Matt? You wanted to read the Aeol and Curufin exchange. Let's see where we page 135, right? Let's have two volunteers. Hey, Jordan, you want to do some more reading? Do you want Aeol or Curufin?
Well, I'll take Curufin. My love for Aeol is not well known.
Since you love him not at all? Okay.
Yes.
Good. All right. Who wants to be Aeol? No volunteers to read Aeol? Yeah, Dave, surely you should read Aeol. You are the one who is speaking up for him. I'll do the little narration bits. We shall end with a dramatic reading. Page 135. Then Curufin said to Aeol,
"What errand have you, dark elf, in my lands? An urgent matter, perhaps, that keeps one so sun-shy abroad by day?"
And Aeol, knowing his peril, restrained the bitter words that arose in his mind.
"I have learned, Lord Curufin,"
he said,
"that my son and my wife, the White Lady of Gondolin, have ridden to visit you while I was from home. And it seemed to me fitting that I should join them on this errand."
Then Curufin laughed at Aeol, and he said,
"They might have found their welcome here less warm than they hoped had you accompanied them. But it is no matter, for that was not their errand. It is 2 days since they passed over the Orisaic, and thence rode swiftly westward. It seems that you would deceive me, unless indeed you yourself have been deceived."
And Aeol answered,
"Then, Lord, perhaps you will give me leave to go and discover the truth of this matter."
"You have my leave, but not my love,"
said Curufin.
"The sooner you depart from my land, the better will it please me."
Then Aeol mounted his horse, saying,
"It is good, Lord Curufin, to find a kinsman thus kindly at need. I will remember it when I return."
Then Curufin looked darkly upon Aeol.
"Do not flaunt the title of your wife before me,"
he said.
For those who steal the daughter, for those who steal the daughters of the Noldor and wed them without gift or leave, do not gain kinship with their kin. I have given you leave to go. Take it and be gone. By the laws of the Eldor, I may not slay you at this time. And this counsel I add, return now to your dwelling in the darkness of Nan Elmoth, for my heart warns me that if you now pursue those who love you no more, never will you return thither.
All right, good. Very good. So what are your favorite bits there? What do we see? We haven't talked much about Curufin and the Sons of Feanor. You know, they sort of come up as sort of subjects of discussion. What can we see here in the Eol versus Curufin discussion? Any thoughts? Oh, Chris, go ahead.
Well, all I was going to say is that it demonstrates the very worst of the behavior of the Noldor in Beleriand. I mean, those are the two of the worst of the sons.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, like everybody at their low point there. Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you have my leave, but not my love. I thought for sure that he took that from Shakespeare because that phrase is so terrific. And I Googled it and I couldn't find it. And I was like, nope, that's original. But that's just one of my favorite phrases in this whole book.
Yeah. You have my leave, but not my love. I agree. I love the way that the way that they're kind of sniping at each other and sort of both being showing a certain degree of sort of false smarmy politeness, though both making it perfectly obvious how much they completely despise each other, until Eol overdoes it a little bit there at the end when he's mounting his horse, and Curufin in that final speech is just like takes the gloves off and is like, all right, all right, man, I'm just gonna come straight out with you. It's sort of the dynamics of that conversation are really interesting. I mean, again, here you can see an illustration, again, Chris, coming back to the point that you were making. You know, just as on the other side, we were talking about Turgon as the example of, you know, the Noldor and the Sindar coming together. Here is a really bad example of the Sindar and a really bad example of the Noldor, showing like the worst kind of illustration of Noldor-Sindar relations.
I was thinking, if Curufin wasn't such a jerk himself, I mean, he is making a valid point about Eol taking Eärendil against her will. So he does have kind of a little bit of moral high ground there, but I think that's well more than offset by his lack of good attitude.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's clear that Curufin does have a point, or at least it is clear that Eol is in the wrong, to try to act as if, especially since we know he's faking, since we know he's lying. I mean, we know he genuinely despises the Noldor, and for him to try kissing up the way that he does here, is pretty disgusting, and Curufin can see through it too. Which makes for an interesting parallel, right? Curufin seeing through Eol like Idril seeing through Maeglin. That's a little uncomfortable and not terribly flattering to Idril, but, well, great. That was fun. Well, it's getting to be time. I think we should probably go. Any final thoughts or, questions?
Can I just ask about Galvorn, the black substance that, Eol makes? Do we ever hear that about that again, or is this the only reference to it?
Well, we'll see the example of it as the black sword of Turin will be made of it. But no, and of course, what naturally it makes me think of, I think what we should be thinking of is Mithril, right? Especially since he developed this in his learning with the dwarves. This is like the dwarves have this special metal that they have discovered and that they have developed and that they know how to work and they keep the secret of it. So does he. And it's like the opposite. Instead of true silver, instead of this silver which is never tarnished and which is always shining and bright, you have this black metal, that Eol creates. So yeah, I mean, it's like the un-Mithril, right? And no, it won't, in itself, we won't see anybody else working in it, because I think Aeol takes the, well, I was going to say, takes the secret to his grave, takes the secret to his little dent in the plane next to Gondolin. But anyway, we will see it, of course, come up. Turin's sword will be made of it. So the blackness of the black sword, will be, you know, we should be remembering Aeol when this comes up. As Dave says, he takes the secret to his puddle. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. yeah, Jordan is complaining about next week's assignment. It is true. I know it's going to be pretty rough, trying to get through that whole chapter next time, but, I hope we can do it. Compared to some of the chapters we've had, it's pretty long. It's almost 10 pages long, but, I think we can make it. And then we start getting into serious stuff. And 2 weeks from now, we'll have to make sure that we're all there to support Jordan 2 weeks from now. Anyway, good night, everybody. Thanks for a particularly fun episode tonight. And we will, look forward to, some good Finrod times next week. Night, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this week's seminar. Before we let you go, though, I'd like to make 3 brief announcements. First, this seminar ran from late 2010 through the end of summer 2011 and broadcast live on Middle Earth Network Radio. Middle Earth Network Radio is a 24/7 streaming internet radio station that plays both music and talk for serious fantasy fans. We host a variety of weekly live shows and special programming, including The Tolkien Professor, that you might enjoy. Find out more and listen live at myemeradio.us and by searching for Middle Earth Network on iTunes. Second, if you enjoy these seminars, you will also enjoy some other projects that its participants are working on for release very soon. This includes a new Silmarillion seminar focused on critical scholarship published about the Silmarillion, and a new podcast entitled The Silmarillionaires, whose motto is Serious Tolkien Scholarship, Even More Serious Tomfoolery. Both will launch later this year, or in early 2012. In the meantime, stay informed by liking the Silmarillionaires Facebook page, following our Twitter account, Silmarillionaire, without the E at the end, and by joining our group on mymiddle-earth.net. If you're interested in getting involved somehow, send me an email at dave@middleearthnetwork.com. Finally, and most important, registration is open for the spring 2012 semester at the Mythgard Institute. The classes read like a modern fantasy greatest hits list, including a Tolkien Lewis class taught by the Tolkien professor himself, and a Harry Potter course taught by the Harry Potter pundits of Pottercast fame. Learn more and sign up for both classes at mythgard.org. Follow the Mythgardian Twitter account, and like the Mythgard Facebook page. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.